Hi, Josh.
Hey, Brink, how are you?
I'm good.
Yeah.
For our viewers out there, I'm Brink Lindsey from the Cato Institute.
Josh Cohen, Stanford University, and Boston Review.
We said we'd start off talking today about the Obama surge, the
Yes.
decision to send 30,000 more troops to
Yeah.
Afghanistan
Yeah. What do you think,
for a
Brink?
year and a half or more.
Yeah. For some indeterminate amount of time, depending on conditions on the ground to some extent anyway.
Yeah.
Something like that. Yeah.
So what's your take?
To start off with getting, I think, two things out of the way I think maybe they're just bugging me, but about things that people are saying, but I think maybe they're getting in the way of some of the discussion. So one thing is there are a bunch of people, and there was a particularly overheated version of this by Gary Wills that's just been posted on the New York Review of Books blog, which is all about a sense of being betrayed by Obama by this decision. And there are lots of things that you can say about this the decision to send in 30,000 more troops on top of having decided back in March to send in 17,000 more. But I think somebody who says that they feel betrayed by this decision has themselves to blame for it.
They weren't paying attention
They
to what he
weren't
was
paying
saying all during
attention,
the
and
campaign.
they weren't paying attention because they didn't take him seriously as a thoughtful, serious, smart, reflective, political guy who'd thought about a lot of stuff before they were, taking Obama as somebody on whom to project their, favorite image or fantasy or hope or whatever about what policies would be. So Obama had said throughout the campaign that more or less the worst thing that he could say about the decision to invade Iraq was that it was took our as thinking of it our eye off the ball where the real ball was in Afghanistan. He described the fight in Afghanistan more recently as a war of necessity, not a war of choice. And you could have decided to support him despite that, which was my decision. I never liked his views on this, or you could have decided not to support him. But I think it's the fault of people who feel betrayed by this that they weren't paying attention and taking him seriously. And I think this Wills thing is a really particularly, as I say, overheated example of that. The other thing that I think people are making too much out of is the issue about, whether the exit date is a date certain or a date conditional or a date partly conditional, and you go in and say, circle this date, this is the date that we're leaving. I think it's pretty clear that this is that, nobody is going to say, we're out of here no matter what's happening on the ground. That wasn't the suggestion. I think there is arguably some significance to saying, here's the picture we've got of what this policy is about and what we're trying to do. And our expectation going in is that we're going to start to move back by, a date in 2011. And I think there's both of those things, the feeling of betrayal at Obama having done something that some of his supporters didn't want him to do, and the exaggerated importance attached to the withdrawal date, whether it's a date certain or not, I think are sort of distractions from the real issue. So what's the real issue? I mean, look, I don't like the policy, but let me, and I'll get to that, but let me say, to put the best face on it, or yeah, the best face on it that I can think of, it's kind of, Biden heavy meets McChrystal light. So it's McChrystal light because McChrystal asked for 40,000 troops and he got 30,000, 30,000 U.S. troops. NATO has said that they're going to send 7,000 or push those numbers up. So it's 30,000 plus the 17,000 back in March. So it's about a doubling of U.S. Troop levels. So it's not everything that McChrystal asked for to that extent. It's McChrystal light. It's Biden heavy, I think, because the emphasis, much more in this speech than in the March, is that this is not supposed to be a nation-building strategy. It's much more of a military strategy. And as I understand it, the logic is something like this. The crucial fight, and emphasized more this time than in March, the crucial fight, what this is really about essentially, is a fight with Al-Qaeda, not in the first instance either a fight with the Taliban or building the Afghan state. And so it's basically a fight with Al-Qaeda plus what you need to do in order to win that fight. So step one is in order to win the fight with Al-Qaeda, the argument is you can't let the Taliban return. And in order to keep the Taliban from returning to power, in order to win the fight with Al-Qaeda, what you have to do is do some stuff about building up the capacity of the Afghan military in particular, but the Afghan state more generally. So that's when I say it's Biden light. It's taking Biden's definition of really what the mission is all about, which is not about nation building in Afghanistan, and then saying, but you can't fight that fight Biden style just with drones or with a smaller force. You need this, you need boots on the ground in Afghanistan. So that's the best face that I can put on it. I just don't look. You know, what do I know? Well, I just don't find this, from what I do know, it just doesn't strike me as a particularly plausible strategy.
No, it seems very measured and moderate and different splitting, and I'm not sure that means it's anything other than just a terrible kludge. I'm opposed to this policy. I think we accomplished about all we could accomplish in Afghanistan by 2002 or so, that we went in there and killed as many Al-Qaeda as we could and chased the rest out of the country, which was absolutely justifiable and needed to be done in the wake of the 9/11 attacks. We also toppled the regime that had made that country into a sanctuary for Al-Qaeda and sent a message to other regimes that they ought not to do that. That was totally justifiable and well worth doing. Since then, we've been stuck in kind of a gradual mission creep of trying to take the most unpromising candidate for nation building on planet Earth and build a nation. And we don't have much to show for it. And I'm highly dubious that another 18 months plus of military action is going to change relevant circumstances. I don't know what we're going to do to fight Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan since they're all in Pakistan. I don't know how we're going to wage a successful counterinsurgency campaign when the Taliban's main calling card has always been that they're less corrupt than the other schmucks that run the place, and the government that's in place now is as corrupt as any, and I don't see much prospect for it to get less so. So my fear is that this is highly unlikely to work. I hope I'm wrong. I hope that this year and a half plus can do some serious degradation of Al-Qaeda through cooperation with Pakistan, that it can do some serious degradation of Taliban forces and give this government some breathing space to build up its own security forces and maybe clean up its act. But I think it's highly unlikely. And my worry is in trying to give Obama the benefit of the doubt here. I don't know. I still don't have a sense of what he really thinks. And I feel like there are three options. One is he really thinks this is going to work, that this interlude of 18 months of ramping up forces is going to be effective and is going to create a substantially more favorable environment for withdrawal 18 months from now than now, and that it will, as part of that, that it will set up a post-withdrawal Afghanistan that's in better shape then than what would happen if we started withdrawing now. So he could really believe that, in which case I think he's probably wrong. And I don't see much reason to think he's right. Second, he could think that the chances for success are dismal at best and probably non-existent, but he has to create some sort of face-saving exit because he campaigned on this and because he's terrified of looking weak on national security.
Right. You can't say it's a war of necessity, not a war of choice in, you know, March, April, and say in November,
right.
I was wrong. It's really a war of choice and we shouldn't be fighting it, because anything that would persuade him of that now ought to have persuaded him that earlier.
Beforehand.
Yeah, terrible.
In which case, yeah, if he really thinks this is a lost cause, but he's going ahead with it anyway, then I think it's really horrible to send American soldiers to their deaths for saving face for the country or saving face for your own administration.
He couldn't possibly believe that. But anyway, go ahead.
I think it's entirely possible.
I think it's entirely possible that he believes that,
I think presidents have committed troops because it was the politically necessary thing to do in their calculation. That's what LBJ did. That's what Nixon stretched out involvement in Vietnam for a long time to create so-called peace with honor. I think people manage administrations have managed lost cause defeats or lost cause wars plenty of times, and I don't think it's in any way a crazy, thinking the worst of this guy or it's a crazy out of bounds charge to make that he doesn't really think this is going to work, but he's going to do it anyway. The final possibility is that this timeline for withdrawal is really weaselly, and he thinks it's unlikely that facts on the ground are going to change significantly in a year and a half, and therefore we're going to stay there in force for a long time. In which case, he's creating the impression, and he definitely created the impression, that this is supposed to be a year and a half surge, and then we start coming out. And so if it's that final alternative, then I think he's being purposefully deceptive to the American people, and I don't like that. So... all three options. One, he thinks he's right, but in which case I think he's probably not right. Second, he knows it's not going to work, but he's doing it anyway, and in which case that seems like just futile throwing good lives after bad. And then third, that he's really being untruthful about his plans to withdraw in the shorter term, and so all three of those look bad to me.
Yeah.
So it's hard for me to put a good face on this.
Yeah.
Even though I agree it's no big shock. He was campaigning on this all along.
Right. So yeah, I don't. With respect, I don't take the second analytical possibility all that seriously, but. I mean, it may be that it's a lost cause, but that they persuaded themselves that it's not psychologically, managed psychologically, persuade themselves of that. I don't think people are sitting around saying this is a lost cause, but we got to, make the best of a bad political thing. So, but so it's really I do think that there's something that seems obviously right about the third. And if you, listen to the testimony and responses to questions given by people in the administration, including the Secretary of State, you know, the date, this is not a hard and fast date of even of the beginning of a withdrawal. So I don't, that stuff, I don't take the date all that seriously. I think it's a kind of sending trying to explain what the policy is and sending a message about current expectations. But, you know, when the time comes, you do what you've got to do. I mean, my reasons for thinking that the Afghan surge is not likely to be a success have something to do with the differences between the conditions in Afghanistan and the conditions in Iraq in 2007, when arguably, I think that the long-term case is still out, but arguably the Iraqi surge was in some measure successful. And I guess I think the one of the big differences, and here I'm taking this from, we've had a pair of articles in Boston in the last Boston Review by Nia Rosen, who's done a lot of on-the-ground reporting in from Iraq and Afghanistan. And his basic case about the success of the surge is that, to the extent that it was a success, was essentially what happened was there was a civil war and the Sunnis lost. Yeah. And by the time you get to 2006, before the surge, with the Sunni awakening Anbar in the first instance, basically what's happened is they say, okay, we lost. And at this point, now that we've lost and we're not going to get control of this this state again, the Americans don't look so bad. So they're more, and Al-Qaeda does look pretty bad. Al-Qaeda in Iraq does look pretty bad. So they're prepared to start behaving differently and regard the Americans not as their worst enemy, but it's because they've essentially lost the war. At the same time, what happens is because the Shias have won, they start fighting each other. And so they start looking pretty bad. And also you get it, you create an opening for the Iraqi government to, you know, start making some headway itself. So, but it's really the exhaustion. It's in Iraq, it's a combination of factors, including the exhaustion that's produced by, a really, really bloody civil war that had been taking place that creates the conditions for success. And then the argument is that the surge played a relatively minor role in a situation in which you had an exhaustion born of a very bloody civil war. And you also had, both by tradition and by, you know, current reality, you had a state.
Whereas in stark contrast, Afghanistan now, millennia and counting, their capacity for ongoing tribal enmity seems inexhaustible.
Right. That seems inexhaustible. It also hasn't been a civil war of the same kind with, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of people getting killed every month. So you don't have exhaustion. Maybe they're inexhaustible anyway, but there's not the exhaustion born of civil war. And you can't wish a state into existence. Also, the big action in Afghanistan is rural and not urban. And, Iraq is to a much more substantial extent an urban city. So these are all reasons for thinking that the counterinsurgency strategy, which arguably had some created some benefit in Iraq beginning in 2007, is very unlikely to have comparable benefit in Afghanistan.
That's right. I guess we both hope we're wrong.
I think that's a fair summary.
Let's move on to another bloody battle, healthcare. The legislation is now in the Senate, and debate is ongoing, and amendments are being discussed. And the last time we talked, You made what I thought was a noteworthy and perhaps
surprising
Panglossian comment that the political process was improving healthcare legislation as it went along. That the process was, you know, sort of bucking you up. That you thought this democracy is messy and so forth, but it looks like this is that it's actually making things better and modulating them in good ways.
Right.
And,
yeah, I didn't only want to eat the sausage that was coming out of the process. I didn't mind it looking at how it was being made. Right.
That's right. Yeah. Do you still feel that way?
Of course.
Yeah.
How can I change my mind? Yeah. I don't know.
So
yeah, I do sort of.
Let me offer some challenges.
Go ahead.
First is the Stupak Amendment. We'll just put that out there.
Yeah.
Secondly is what looks to be first on the House side and now
you said this
progressively
the,
on the
stupid. Oh, I'm sorry. The Stupak Amendment.
Yeah.
That was the first.
That's
okay.
Right.
Yeah. Good. Okay. Yeah.
Secondly, the slow evisceration, attenuation of any seriousness about cost controls, and particularly Medicare cost controls. On the House side, the whole idea of a Medicare commission got stripped out of the bill altogether. On the Senate side, there is a commission,
right.
But it exempts doctors and medical equipment suppliers and hospices forever, and from its purview, it exempts hospitals for 10 years.
Yeah.
The trigger for its recommendations taking effect has been changed in the Senate bill from a situation in which the trigger was that Medicare costs rise faster than overall economic growth. The new trigger is that per capita Medicare spending rises faster than overall healthcare spending. The first trigger happens pretty much all the time.
Yeah, yeah.
The second trigger almost never happens.
Yeah.
So it's basically gone to very unlikely situation in which this commission would have any relevance. Then you've got these pilot programs about how to reduce costs basically by steering things away from fee-for-service medicine and more towards a kind of capitation approach.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. But all of these pilot projects are structured so that HHS is unable to expand any of them if they're successful without congressional approval. So you'll have to get another, you have to have Congress taking another whack at it, and good luck with that. So there on the cost control side, it looks like Will is crumbling. Also, just to throw in, there was an amendment added yesterday to make routine mammograms, make that mandatory as part of all plans. So just, the kind of typical predictable gold plating of mandated coverage seems to be gearing up. Then the final thing I would add is nothing unusual for Washington, but you're a deliberative Democrat. These things ought to distress you. And that is the just shameless chicanery about numbers. The idea, there's this big deal, I don't know quite why, but a big push to keep the 10-year costs of this bill as calculated in the political process under $1 billion, under $1 trillion, excuse me.
Yeah.
So the Senate bill comes in at $850 billion, and that looks lean. But the reason it looks lean is because the first 4 years of the 10-year period, there's nothing happening. 99% of the spending in this 10-year window happens in the last 6 years. If you took the real 10 years of the first 10 years when spending actually happened, it would be $1.8 trillion, not $850 billion, so basically an extra trillion there.
Yeah.
Then on the another big political imperative is to make this look deficit neutral, which is a good idea since we're swimming in red ink and look to be swimming even more deeply in years ahead. And there, the way things are packaged makes it look deficit neutral, but the main reason for that is they stripped out the so-called doc fix, which is a permanent reversal of what had been an annual temporary reversals of these cuts in Medicare reimbursements to doctors. They stripped that out of the healthcare bill, even though it will be passed in sync with it, and indeed the healthcare bill can't pass unless the doc fix bill passes, because that's the price for doctors' support for the healthcare bill. So really it's a package deal, but they've separated it into two parts so that the $200 billion plus of the doc fix doesn't count on the deficit calculation. So a lot of just, you know, lying through their teeth about numbers, which is ugly, typical, but still ugly. So anyway, that's my read on how the political process is shaping up healthcare reform, and it's not a pretty picture.
Yeah, and apart from that, Mrs. Lincoln, how was the show? Couple of things, maybe only by way of finding some way of interpreting what I said last time that I can still stick with. So there are two basic issues about two basic dimensions for evaluating the legislation. One is, does it improve access so that you get pretty much universal access? Yeah. And the other is, does it do something on costs? And something on, and okay, so on the first thing, on the access issue, I think we're agreed that it's the access is considerably, access to health insurance is, and therefore to health care is considerably expanded, not absolutely universal, but considerably expanded. And that's been, you know, one of the, a disaster of the American system of social provision. So I think that's good. And the legislative, on this issue about the legislative process, the process hasn't particularly improved that over the course of the last, you know, 6 months of 7 months, however long it's been of, quote, deliberations, unquote, but it hasn't made that worse. On the cost issue, I think without disputing, just for the sake of argument now, any of the things that you were just saying, I think there are two issues. Number one is, there are three metrics that I would look to. Number one, does the legislation do better or worse than the status quo in terms of holding down the costs of medical care in the United States, which costs are going to bankrupt us? And nothing that you've said really, I think, speaks to that issue. I don't think any of the concerns that you've raised says that we're going to have a larger percentage of, you know, GDP going to healthcare in 10 years than we would have with the status quo. Not that you're in favor of the status quo, but that's...
I'm not sure about that. I mean, we're definitely expanding subsidies to use healthcare. That's the whole purpose of widening access, is to get more people in the system. So I think that's not... I understand that keeping down healthcare, overall healthcare spending by ensuring that tens of millions of people don't get much healthcare is, that's not a good way of going about it. We're increasing subsidies
subsidies
to use healthcare subsidies.
Right. But this is the whole point of the reform, is that you can't deal with the cost issue without also dealing with the access issue.
Demand for healthcare. So that to me makes the cost situation worse than it otherwise would have been.
Spending.
The spending is what matters.
I'm not talking about spending. I'm talking about the first metric that I proposed was Yeah. You look at current projections on the, given the status quo on what the country is going to be spending as a percentage of GDP. Yes. And GDP, I haven't seen anybody say that under these health care reforms, what's going to happen is we're going to be spending a larger percentage. That's a disaster. The current situation, which I know you don't support, is a disaster for the American economy. So that's a first point. The second point is, here's another metric. If you, basically, there's a, there was a very good piece on this by Jonathan Cohn at the New Republic, who I think should get, in my view, should get, maybe there are others as well, but he should get an award for the quality of the writing that he's done on this issue, which I think is very, very good, sensible, balanced, smart, informative, et cetera. Not the only one, but I think his stuff has been particularly good.
He's extremely well informed and a good journalist. I disagree with him, but yeah, I agree. I agree. He's doing a good job.
Yeah. So he made the argument that with a certain qualification that I'm gonna that's very much relevant to what we're talking about here. That if you want to know what the current legislation is going to produce at the national level, look at what happened in Massachusetts with the healthcare reform in Massachusetts, because what's being proposed basically to a pretty significant degree, both the Senate and the House legislation changing by the minute, to be sure, looks something like the system that was adopted in Massachusetts. No public particularly if you've got no public option. And one of the differences in Massachusetts is that when they adopted the legislation, they really didn't do very much on the cost side. And they're trying to deal with that now.
Right.
And, you know, we'll see whether they're successful or not in dealing with that. But I think a second.
Right. They had promised that by getting everybody in the system and cutting out the free riding that you'd see premiums coming down. And in fact, premiums are up.
But they didn't.
Therefore, on the whole issue of bankrupting and, you know, with out of control spending, thus far, the Massachusetts plan has made matters worse.
This is the difference, I think, with the federal legislation is that there has been, we don't know successful or not yet, but there has been, I think, a pretty serious effort, partly because of the demands of the political process for some sort of compromise. There's been a serious effort to try to do something about the cost issue. And I don't think it's all been, with all due respect, I do think that I have somewhat more confidence. Maybe this is just ideology, but I have somewhat more confidence in the Peter Orszag view of this than in the Brink Lindsey view of this. And I think Orszag has been emphasizing the ways in which there are serious cost control. Anyway, the point is the measures in the legislation, and the point is that it's been taken more seriously than it was taken in Massachusetts. And then the third metric I would just put on the table is my point last time was that, you know, compare the legislation now with where it was when it was first introduced.
Right.
And I think one of the things that's happened, whether it's going to be successful or not, we don't know yet. And I'm putting aside the Stupak Amendment, which I think is terrible, awful. On these issues about cost and access, I don't think the cost situation is worse as a consequence of the legislative process than it was at the beginning of the legislative process. I think it's arguably better. Now, you may think that's comparing, you know, horrific disaster with mere disaster, but that was still, you know, if the legislative process gets you from horrific disaster to mere disaster, you know, that's an improvement, and it doesn't make the legislative process look so bad. And I'm not a student of congressional history, and so this is a very, very superficial impression of a kind of an observer rather than a student of the process. But when I think of big pieces of legislation that have been that have emerged over the past 20 years or so, 30 years, this one, for, you know, for reasons that have to do with the Obama political strategy and efforts to learn something from the failure of healthcare reform in 93-94,
right.
this legislation is, to a much larger degree than big pieces of legislation that I can think of, a product of, you know, congressional, you know, Senate, House debate and politics, and not a kind of, you know, executive. This is not a legislation produced by the executive branch. I think
Correct.
That's kind of good, if assuming that a decent piece of legislation does emerge. I think that's pretty good for the political process. And I can't resist just one last point on one of the issues that you raised about the Medicare issue, Medicare cost control. I think, and my guess is you probably agree with me about this, is that one of the worst things about what the Republicans have been doing on the healthcare issue is trying to make sure that whatever happens here, there isn't any Medicare cost control.
Right. It's complete, utter shameless demagoguery. There's I find there's, you know, some karma as Democrats have engaged in Republican bashing Medicare demagoguery for so long. Grimly amusing to watch them get a taste of their own medicine. But
yes.
But yes, it's shameful.
It is.
So let me say, I mean, first of all, I just reject this whole approach to healthcare reform. I think the whole employer based tax sheltered prepayment of medical expenses we call health insurance system is broken, and we ought not to be expanding it. We ought to be rethinking it. So, but bracket that. Taking this on its own terms, yes, it looks like it will improve access to the system, and that is a good thing. There is a possibility that things could come unraveled, and that is that lurks in the relative weakness of the fines that back up the mandate. So you've got these three things that have to go together, you've got these two health insurance changes or regulations that are key to this approach, which are guaranteed issue, so you can't deny somebody because of a pre-existing condition.
Yeah.
And community rating, got to charge everybody the same thing, regardless of their risk factors. If you have those two things and no mandate, then you have a completely collapsed system.
Yes.
Because it's in everybody's interest to not be insured until they're sick.
Right.
And then you just show up, and so then everybody who's healthy goes out of the system, and the whole cross-subsidization of the insurance market falls apart, and it's a death spiral, and it's the end of it.
Yeah.
So we have to have a mandate if you're going to have community rating and guaranteed issue. The question is this mandate really enough of a mandate? And right now the fines are, as I understand it, create incentives for lots of people that if they are just utility maximizers, they will drop their insurance and pay the fine and then get insurance when they get sick. My understanding is that the people who are scoring this, CBO folks, are saying that it's unlikely for people to game the system to the extent that it's economically irrational to do so, that the social norms will just make people follow the mandate. And my guess is that's probably true, at least for a while. But there is lurking in there a systemic weakness of a big incentive to drop insurance that could prove problematic on the access side because people will just drop out of the system.
It's hard to know whether it's a safer bet to bet on people being rational, or safer bet to bet on them being irrational.
So there's something about
the psychology of a fine, I guess.
On its surface, it looks like this is expanding access. So mission accomplished on that score.
Good.
Although there is a danger lurking.
Right.
On the cost control side, the argument, I think most, you know, serious people who know what's going on, if you force them to, you know, admit whether they think that these cost control elements in this legislation as it's shaping up are going to be effective or not. They see that they're getting weakened, and they see that there's all kind of loopholes, I think that you'll get a fair amount of concession that this piece of legislation isn't going to do the cost curve bending that needs to be done,
that's going to be
work for a later day.
Yeah.
And the argument is it's kind of twofold. First, that we can't really do cost control until we've got the universal access. That's what allows us then to really get serious about cost control,
yeah,
because we're not doing it on the backs of the uninsured anymore. And then lurking in there also is this idea that, hell, we're doomed anyway. We're facing fiscal apocalypse just already with current Medicare.
Jump in with both feet.
So the idea is, you know, we're heading towards a cliff at 30 miles an hour, and we all know we've got to hit the brakes. So one way to really improve the incentives for hitting the brakes is to ramp it up to 80 miles an hour for a while. I think that's unsound, and we'll see. I feel quite bearish about the prospects for saying no to all of these vested interests, saying no to the hospital, saying no to doctors, saying no to patients that want every test and every procedure, until the fiscal wrecking ball really starts knocking floors off the building. So I'm quite pessimistic that this legislation or even any short-term follow-up legislation is going to do the prudent thing, that we're going to, I'm afraid, have to wait for stuff to really be going wrong badly so that we're paying serious economic consequences for our fiscal incontinence
So
the nettle is grasped.
Yeah. So
by which time we will have made that situation much, much worse by having a long run of out of control spending. That's bad.
I think the current situation projecting outward from the status quo disaster. You're not going to get the rethinking that you want of the basically employer-based healthcare system. Not the rethinking that you would like. I'm not going to get the rethinking that I would like. I'm more, as you know, we've talked about this before. To the extent that I have, considered views about this, I'm more of a single payer guy. But that's not going to happen. Either yours isn't going to happen, mine isn't going to happen. So there are two possibilities. One is that you don't do anything big, and you kind of muddle along with improvements or worsenings, like the drug bill from the Bush administration, you do something like what's being done, and you have a big change that does give you, or probably, I think we agree, probably a big gain on the access issue, and puts the issue of controlling the cost of medical care to the economy directly as an issue about controlling the cost of medical care in the budget. And I think that, I like the access, and I don't think that I don't see that there's a smaller prospect of dealing with the big issue of pushing the percentage of GDP going to healthcare to 25% or 30% or 50%. I don't think there's a lesser chance of dealing with that issue through this reform than there is of dealing with it without reform. I think there's a better chance that you'll deal with that big issue of the nightmare to the American economy of 25% or 35% of the economy going to hell here. I think that you improve the chances with this thing, but it
we
does.
Shall see.
Yeah, we shall. We will see, and we'll probably disagree
so
in the future also.
Yeah.
But as long as we're on happy topics,
yeah, we're uh, we've we've been going on for a while now. We don't have that much longer to go, but I did want to talk about ClimateGate and get your read on that. Well, I'll give you my 2 cents, but I want to hear your reaction first.
Well, so there are three issues about ClimateGate. First of all, there are the emails.
Yes.
Then there's the data dump from the 1980s, and then there's the issue of the news coverage of the issue. And I want to start with that last one first, because I find it really kind of bothersome. I've read around about the ClimateGate thing a lot, I mean, to the extent that it's possible to read about it. And what I find really disturbing, maybe not shocking, but disturbing, is it's very, maybe you've read something that does this, and please tell me. I haven't found a single article that really kind of starts from the beginning on this, explains the role of the East Anglia group in, you know, climate science, you know, how important they were, what other groups are operating, and what bearing on, you know, a sensible assessment of the evidence the ClimateGate issue should have. I've seen very partisan things that say it's all a non-issue. I've seen very partisan things that say, you know, we won, you lost, get a life.
Yeah, right.
But it's very hard to find a serious discussion of the thing that starts from the beginning.
Yeah, I haven't seen any kind of, you know, one-stop shopping on that really sets the context. I agree with that. It may be out there. I just don't know. I think we should distinguish between, does this mean that the evidence for anthropogenic global warming is now, you know, bunk? No, it doesn't mean that. There's lots of other data sources besides East Anglia. There's you know, satellite temperature records from more recently. Even if you put aside their data dump, you know, the irretrievability of historical data, we still got more recent data. We've got a lot of other folks who've and so the basic conclusion that we had a warming up episode between the 70s and 90s, the mid 70s and late 90s, and that rising CO2 emissions played some role in that, that all seems to me still completely intact. The question always, and apart from, you know, a fringe, even in the skeptic community, none of that has really been denied. That is, a lot of people that are called skeptics are people who are completely recognized that temperatures have been going up in recent decades, although not in the past decade, and that CO2 has almost certainly played a role.
Well,
the question is,
so first, temperatures going up. Second, higher CO2 concentrations. Third, higher CO2 concentrations, a source of the temperatures going up. Maybe that's obvious. And then fourth, the anthropogenic side of this, that the higher CO2 concentrations that are driving the temperature increases are a product of human activity. Right.
Yeah. Okay. So the big question in my mind is, you know, how big a deal is this? What are the what's the reliability of models projecting out into the future? Are we talking about, you know, there's just all the difference in the world between saying there's anthropogenic global warming and it's going to add another half a degree or degree Celsius, and saying it's going to add several degrees or 10 degrees.
Right.
And so, and then there's all the associated theories about how rising overall global temperatures could affect
everything:
sea levels, droughts, all kinds of stuff.
Violence, food, droughts.
Yeah.
Value of beachfront property. Yeah.
So to me, the the big deal about this, and what we've what I think we've seen is a concerted effort by folks to avoid FOIA requests and to frustrate efforts to check their data and their analysis of data. So basically, a concerted effort to frustrate the scientific review process, and that's bad.
Right.
Secondly, the loss of data, and that's bad because now that's again frustrating the capacity to recreate and reproduce results or mm-hmm. show that they're not reproducible.
Right.
And then thirdly, a concerted effort to keep skeptics out of peer-reviewed journals and then claim that you shouldn't pay attention to the skeptics because they don't publish in the peer-reviewed journals. So what you see is really, I think, politicized, ideologically skewed science. And all along, the most potent kind of weapon that climate change alarmists have had is this idea of pristine, above it all, science, proclaiming that the science is settled and bad things are going to happen unless we act now. And that curtain has been yanked back, at least for some big players in this climate science establishment, and shows that that in fact they're not above I left out massaging numbers and you know, engaging in chicanery, and that's important. It's not just important on its own because it's just bad that an important question is being dealt with by bad actors, but it's also, I think, important in changing the kind of level of deference that people like me, who don't know anything about climate science, should be giving to the scientific establishment. Okay.
I agree with most of that. There are a few tonal points that I'm not sure I agree with, but I think the damage, not just, yes, here's something that I know we agree on. Science is important, and
yes,
really important. Maybe this is a trivial thing to say, but done right, it's owed, a kind of deference because of the kind of process that it is, and to, for people to be acting badly in the ways that you described is damaging, not only in this area at the deference owed to people who are doing climate science, but also damaging to the claims of scientific authority generally, which I think is really very, very damaging. So I think that on the data law, just a few smaller points. On the data loss issue, I think there's a lot. In some ways, this is the most worrisome thing because they're rechecking the historical temperature record on the basis of the data that was in East Anglia. It can't be done anymore. Original data isn't around anymore. That data dump was done in the 1980s, when they moved buildings. It's before global warming was an issue.
That does not seem to be motivated but politically.
Yeah, just, so that I think is in a separate category. That's unfortunate.
My understanding is that assembling a global temperature record over decades and more than a century is just a phenomenally difficult thing to do. You've got all these temperature records that don't really, they're apples and oranges, and you've got to normalize them, and you've got to massage them to make them tell a coherent story.
Right.
And so that now that we suspect that maybe their reconstruction of the temperature record was, you know, might have been guided by ideological motivations, that really seems all the more important for somebody else to go back and look at the raw data again. And and now we can't.
That's why I think that's the most serious concern, although it's the one which is least plausibly motivated by badly motivated because the data dump was done in the 1980s before whatever massaging was done in order to be, as you described, the telecoherent story was done at a time when, if anything, there were sort of concerns in the air about global cooling rather than about global warming. So it's a really unfortunate result. I do think, though, that the main issue here, apart from the kind of socio-cultural political status of science and the kind of authority that it's owed in this area and in other areas, with no small issue, the big issue here is what conclusions ought we to draw about the case for global warming from all of this stuff? And here that's the most important issue, I think. And I basically agree with what I think I heard you to be saying, which is that I haven't seen anybody make the case that that the conduct in East Anglia, indicated in the emails, indicates any that there's any reason for people to change their mind about the issue, because there are other data sources available, stuff on what's happened with global temperature, about four different sources of data on what's happened with global temperatures over the past 150 years, and they all look pretty much exactly alike. So I don't think this the damage to the reputation of the people in this area is troubling, and the damage to the reputation of science, I think, is troubling. But
my hope is that this will be a very healthy development.
I do want to add one point here, though.
That because of the intersection of science and politics on a hugely important issue, it looks like scientists stopped acting like scientists. Right. They stopped sort of reveling in the ambiguity of their data, and they were scared about it. They were trying to cover up the fact that the data was messy in a way that scientists ought not to do that. They were concerned about PR. They were worried about, trying to fend off people who were, good faith scientific investigators who had a different point of view.
Right.
It was just all bad. Right. And on an issue this, incredibly important, I understand the thought processes that lead one to say this is really important and we shouldn't let the niggling little uncertainties obscure the big picture, and so therefore we should be good team players and present the party line to the dumb public.
Right.
But that's just not the way it ought to happen. And so if the scientific process can be more opened, if we can get folks who are operating within the general consensus that you and I outlined earlier, but still having serious debates about A, the scale of the temperature increase, and B, the climate effects of any given temperature increase, then perhaps a more open, less politicized process could lead us ultimately to better policymaking.
Yeah, I agreeing. I think I agree with that. I wanted to add one of the things that I think is issue here is sidebar point, which is that there are unfortunate analogies with some of what happened with some economists after the financial crisis, which there was a similar kind of drawing around, and there had been that earlier. Don't pay any attention. And there are these bad behavior and forms of clubbiness that are damaging to all of us. One of the things, though, here is that, as you say, there are, you know, there are climate skeptics, warming skeptics, and there are warming skeptics.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you're, you know, a serious and well-motivated and well-intentioned and non-fudging person in this area, and what you respond, and so you get up every day and you think, do I have to respond again today to the people who say, there isn't any warming, that's a bunch of bunk. And even if there is some warming, it's not so damaging. Disaster scenarios, a bunch of bunk. And even if there is warming, and even if it is going to be really damaging, besides that, this is just natural forcing, not human activity. It's not our fault. And there is, you know, there is a two to tango aspect here. There's only so much time, you know, when you're a serious, well-intentioned, honest, non-fudging person who's involved on the, in doing work in this area, there's only so much time and patience that you can, that I think it's reasonable to
have for
people who are for the Inhofs of the world who are banging at the door, saying no warming, not damaging, not our fault. You know, they learned how to argue in the alternative when they're in law school, and they're doing it to a fairly well on this issue. So this is not,
Of course it's discouraging if you're a scientist to have to, and you're operating in an area of public concern, to have to deal with crazy cranks all the time. And so if you're an evolutionary biologist having to deal with the whatever new form of creationism, you know, it's wearisome, right? And it's the least fun part about being a scientist in that area.
And it's also, I know this from my experience in trying to get serious scientists to write about some of these issues for Boston Review.
Yep.
I mean, I have had, there's a person who I was a very distinguished microbiologist who has had some stuff that about how to understand, I won't go into the details of it, I don't understand it well enough, but it's very important stuff that bears on a fundamental issue about explaining how you get apparently perfectly designed creatures around without a designer. And wanted to get this person to write something, not about, you know, intelligent design or creationism or anything like that, but just about this research, which has a bearing on that. And the scientist, that I won't say he or she, because I don't want to, didn't want to do it. And they didn't want to do it because they did not want to be involved in the, you know, kind of political, you know, in a political argument. They wanted to publish the research and hope that in the fullness of time, it had the desired effect. So one of the things that happens because of the, you know, because of the pushback from the cranks who have, you know, nothing better to do than waste your time. One of the consequences of that is that I think it helps to drive out of the discussion people who have some of the, you know, the kinds of intellectual cautiousness and scrupulousness that you'd like to see more of, and you have what you end up with is that the people who are playing in the political discussion on these issues are the people who are much more prepared to mix it up and to, you know, maybe oversimplify, not maybe, but oversimplify for the sake of public discussion. And I think the same is true on the climate side. And
this already happens,
just on the lessons of this, and maybe this is already happening on the climate skeptic side, but one of the things I think that it means on the climate skeptic side is that it's really arguably the responsibility of on that side to say, listen, you know, I've got a kind of reasonable, sensible kind of skepticism here, and don't confuse me with the people who are in some broad and general way on my team, but are making me look bad.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, it's a bummer to have to deal with cranks, but science thrives on skeptics, even if they're wrong.
Right.
You need them around always, poking holes at your arguments, poking holes at your data, raising serious questions to keep the whole process honest. I think there is real evidence that there's a good number of very serious, data-driven, non-crank scientists who deviate from the party line in one respect or another on global warming alarmism. That is, they dispute whether the temperature rise has been as much as it has. They dispute the extent to which CO2 has been implicated. CO2 is driving this. They dispute the kind of positive feedback mechanisms from CO2 forcing that are needed to get the big effects that alarmists warn about. And they've been getting stiffed and marginalized and you know, sharp elbowed, it looks like, by a bunch of you know, politicized scientists. And I hope now that we can, that now that the, you know, the spotlight has shone on this, that they can cut it out and we can get science to go back to doing what it's supposed to do.
I think there are two articles that would be useful to have people write, and I haven't seen them written yet. One is the thing that I was describing at the beginning, where it's somebody, particularly somebody who's not a skeptic, who says, you know, some bad stuff has happened. Let me start at the beginning, explain why this doesn't change my mind and why it shouldn't change your mind on the substance of the issue, even though the behavior was bad. And I haven't seen that piece written yet. I think what would the second article would be very useful to have somebody write is to have a climate skeptic write an article in which the climate skeptic distinguishes, as you are, between the skeptics and the cranks.
Right.
And so there, I don't want to go in for some fake balance here. But I do think that there's some importance in some responsibility for the shared responsibility for the politicization. And I think a climate skeptic could contribute to the depoliticization of the issue, turning it into a science issue by saying, you know, I'm not Inhofe, not Sensenbrenner. Yep. You know, I'm not somebody who calls John Holdren, you know, the socialist science czar. I think there's a legitimate issue here. And here's what I think is wrong with the crank arguments. And here's where I disagree with some of the cranks. Here's what I think the substance of the issue is. I haven't seen either of those articles written.
Yeah, I'd like to read both.
Me too. Okay.
We've been talking for more than an hour, so we should probably shut up now. And but I always like talking with you, and I hope we'll do it again soon.
Enjoyed it. Okay, good to talk, Brent.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Take care, Josh. Bye-bye.